to the 24th chapter of the book of Matthew. We establish some context first by turning to Luke 19, verses 41 through 44. This records Jesus' comments as he comes into the city of Jerusalem for his final week of ministry. We noted how he, when he came in view of the city, began weeping. And his weeping was on behalf of his brethren, his countrymen, who would in less than 40 years suffer destruction at the hands of the Romans because of their rejection of Jesus as the Messiah. We then turned over to the 23rd chapter of Matthew and considered what Jesus had to say to the leadership of the Jews in verses 37 through 39. He laments once again how Jerusalem had rejected all the prophets that had been sent to them. One after another, they had killed them. They had rejected their message. They were not willing to listen. And finally, God had sent his only son to them, and they had rejected him as well. We noted in chapter 24 that Jesus and his disciples were passing out of the temple, and as they were, the disciples were pointing out the various structures, remarking at how beautiful they were. And Jesus responds in verse 2 that these things will be destroyed. And of course, being a Jew, this would have shook you to your very core. And so the disciples in verse 3 come to Jesus in private and pose three questions. When will these things be? In other words, when will the temple be destroyed? The second question, what will be the sign of your coming? Recall back in chapter 23, verse 39, Jesus tells them, you will see me no more till you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. He tells them that he's going to leave, he's going to be gone for a while, but that when he returns, everyone, even those who rejected him at first, will acknowledge the fact that he is in fact the Lord and the Messiah at that point. And the final question, verse 3, is what will be the sign of the end of the age? This morning we took a look at verses 4 through 15, which I believe begin to answer question number 1, these 9 indicators of the events leading up to the destruction of Jerusalem. We talked about the historical events that fulfilled this prophecy. But before we go on to verse 16 this evening, I would like to make one final comment about this list of indicators. When you look at this list, there is only one of these indicators that is truly unique to the destruction of Jerusalem. And that is this final indicator, the abomination of desolation. All the rest of these we could look at being fulfilled throughout history in various capacities. There have been people that have claimed that Jesus Christ has returned, that we've missed him. There will always be wars and rumors of wars. There will always be famines, pestilences, and earthquakes throughout the earth. Christians have been persecuted since Acts chapter 7 and will continue to be persecuted, I'm convinced, till the end of time. People within Christianity betray one another. We've seen civil wars happen as a result of this. We see false prophets going out among people, teaching false messages. Love growing cold within the church happens as a result of standing against false teaching. The gospel continues to be preached to the whole world. That is a generational thing. That continues to happen. It's cyclical, if you will. But it's when you take all 9 of these indicators and put them together, what you have are the events that lead up to the destruction of Jerusalem. Every generation looks at these first dates and says, well, we see all these things going on right now. It must be the end of time. Let me give you an example. In 1453, the Turkish Empire conquered the city of Constantinople, a very significant point in history. The reaction in Europe was one of doomsday, one of great alarm. In fact, the papacy was calling for another crusade against the Turkish Empire. People thought it was the end of the world. They looked at this list and they thought to themselves, well, here it is. It's right here on our doorsteps. In fact, Martin Luther fancied himself to be a Latter-day prophet. He thought he was the man commissioned by God to go to the Catholic Church to reform it, to prepare the bride of Christ for his arrival. Brothers and sisters, we're almost 500 years later, and Jesus still has not returned. Every generation believes that it's the final generation. Every generation looks at these first 8 indicators and wonders, is this it? But let's not forget the context in which Matthew 24 is delivered. The context is based on the questions that are posed by the disciples in verse 3. When will these things be? They're talking about the destruction of the temple. And I believe that Jesus, in giving us these indicators, also just tells us how things are going to be for the rest of time. This is how mankind is going to conduct his business, if you will. Let's proceed on to verses 16 through 28. Let me give you a little idea of how I view verses 16 through 28. To me, these 13 verses comprise three general warnings that Jesus gives to his disciples. The first we find beginning in verse 16. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him who is on the housetop not go down to take anything out of his house. And let him who is in the field not go back to get his clothes. There's warning number one. And the warning is essentially this. When Jerusalem is surrounded by armies, get out. Don't wait. Know that its destruction is imminent, and don't stick around to find out, because you will not be spared. You will not be spared. Flee to the mountains. Get away as fast as possible. Jesus amplifies these comments later on in verses 32 through 34. Notice what he says here. Now learn this parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and puts forth leaves, you know that summer is near. So you also, when you see all these things, remember those two words from verse 2. When you see these things, know that it is near at the doors. Assuredly, I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things take place. Jesus has given all these indicators to the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and specific to his disciples, so that they will know that when the time comes, get out and get out now. Don't stick around. Just as you can tell when the fig tree is about to bloom, so you will know. When the army surrounds the city of Jerusalem and all these things have taken place, you can be confident that its destruction is imminent and get out. That's Jesus' first warning. What's interesting about this is that Jerusalem was actually surrounded twice during this period leading up to its destruction. The first one actually happens in 67 AD. The Syrian governor Cestius pursued Jewish rebels to Jerusalem. He encamped around Jerusalem for 3 days. He sent out some skirmishes. And what ended up happening, according to Josephus, is that Cestius, and this is an exact quotation from Josephus, retired from the city without any reason in the world. Now think about that for a moment. If you're a Jewish Christian living in Jerusalem, you see an army surround the city, you think back to this prophecy that Jesus has uttered, and then all of a sudden after 3 days they just depart for no reason. How are you going to react, brothers and sisters? Are you going to know something's up? Absolutely. In other words, God gives them 3 years to get out of Jerusalem. They see this happen once. They see the army flee. They don't see the army flee. They see it retreat, I should say. They see the army depart. And what should that lead them to do? It should lead them to leave. God gives his people ample warning to follow this instruction from the Lord. And we see later on in 70 AD, 3 years later, that this city is eventually destroyed. Warning number two by Jesus begins in verse 19. But woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days. And pray that your flight may not be in winter or on the Sabbath. For then there will be great tribulation, such as has not been since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be. And unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved, but for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. Jesus' second warning is, these will be difficult days. These are going to be terrible days. And in fact, as he says in verse 21, they will be the worst days upon the earth prior to that point, and there will be no days even worse after that. Someone after service this morning said it's hard to conceive the Jews suffering any more than they did under the Holocaust. Yet according to Jesus' testimony, Jerusalem during the siege was far worse. Let me read just a quotation or two from Josephus. When he was reflecting back on the Jewish rebellion and the eventual destruction of Jerusalem, Josephus writes this observation. Accordingly, it appears to me that the misfortunes of all men from the beginning of the world, if they be compared to these Jews, are not so considerable as they were. Josephus is essentially saying the same thing that Jesus uttered in verse 21. No man since the beginning of time suffered like these Jewish people did during this siege. There was suffering on a scale that is hard for us to conceive or imagine. Josephus writes this after the city was encircled by the Roman army. So all hope of escaping was now cut off from the Jews, together with their liberty of going out of the city. Then did the famine widen its progress and devoured the people by whole houses and families. The upper rooms were full of women and children that were dying by famine, and the lanes of the city were full of dead bodies of the aged. The children also and the young men wandered about the marketplaces like shadows, all swelled with the famine, and fell down dead wheresoever their misery seized them. He goes on to say later on in this very same paragraph that they got to the point that they stopped burying the bodies because there was just no place left to bury them. So many people were dying from this famine. Jesus says that these will be difficult days, and indeed they were. But notice what he extends in verse 22. Unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved, but for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. In other words, he offers hope. And even though the Jewish Christians have fled from the city, even though all these terrible things are happening, do not despair. God has not forgotten you. God will not leave you alone. And this is a message that is consistent throughout prophecy. Whenever God pronounces judgment upon people, he often extends hope as a result. And this is precisely what Jesus utters as well. Even though these will be terrible days, even for those who flee the city and have to go through some difficult times not being there at home, Jesus extends hope amidst all this misery. Warning number two, these will be difficult days. And finally, warning number three, we find, beginning in verse 23. Then if anyone says to you, look, here is the Christ, or there, do not believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will rise and show great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect. See, I have told you beforehand. Therefore, if they say to you, look, he is in the desert, do not go out. Or look, he is in the inner rooms, do not believe it. For as the lightning comes from the east and flashes to the west, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. For wherever the carcass is, there the eagles will be gathered together. This warning concerns the disciples not being deceived by false Christ. And it's akin to what he has to say back in verses 4 and 5, which we discussed this morning. Remember what Josephus had to say at this time. He said the land was overrun with magicians, seducers, and imposters who drew the people after them in multitudes, notice this next part, into solitudes and deserts, to see the signs and miracles which they promised to show by the power of God. According to Josephus' testimony, false messiahs were luring the people out to deserted places, off to solitudes, in order to deceive them with what they claimed to be wonders from God. Remember what Jesus said in verse 26, therefore if they say to you, look, he is in the desert, do not go out. Or look, he is in the inner rooms, do not believe it. This was precisely what was taking place in these days leading up to Jerusalem's destruction. And Jesus' message to his disciples is very clear. Don't worry, you'll know when I return. Don't be deceived by reports that I have returned. And he gives us an illustration in verse 27. For as the lightning comes from the east and flashes to the west, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. Brothers and sisters, if you're standing out in a lightning storm, and you've got your eyes open, are you going to miss the lightning flashing around you? Absolutely not. And Jesus' message is this. If you've got your eyes open and you're looking for my return, are you going to miss me? No. You're not going to miss me. For as the lightning flashes from the east to the west, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. You're not going to miss that bolt of lightning if you've got your eyes open. And if you've got your eyes open and you're watching for the return of Jesus, you will not miss his return. So do not be deceived by these messages of false Christ out in solitudes and in deserted places. Do not be misled. You'll know when I return. And as he concludes in verse 28, it's not difficult to find a carcass out in the middle of nowhere, is it? You can find a carcass very easily, can you not? It's where all the vultures are at. And Jesus' message there is consistent with the one in verse 27. You'll be able to see me. You'll be able to find me. Don't be deceived. Don't follow these reports, for they are false. Three warnings Jesus gives to his disciples in verses 16 through 28 concerning these times. Get out immediately. These will be difficult days. And do not be deceived by reports of my return. You'll know when I return. Verses 29 through 31 represent some of the most difficult parts of this chapter to interpret. And I'm not going to pretend to be an authority on these three verses, but I think what I have to offer to you this evening is very reasonable, if you will. I believe verse 29 still has to do with this first question. And as I cited up here on the board this morning, verses 4 through 29 and verses 32 through 34 have to do with answering when will the destruction of the temple take place. And I believe verse 29 is tied in with Jesus' answer to that question. Verses 30 and 31 seem to me to be an answer to the second question, and we'll get into that in just a moment. Let's take a look at verse 29. Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. First of all, notice in verse 29, the very specific language that Jesus uses. He uses a very specific, if you will, time element. He says, immediately after the tribulation of those days. In other words, all these difficult days that I've been talking about connected with the destruction of Jerusalem, this is going to happen right after them. Immediately after the tribulation of those days. That's key. So here we have a prophecy concerning this event right here. Something that's going to take place right after these days of tribulation. When you read about the sun being darkened, the moon not giving its light, and the stars falling from heaven, the first thing that probably pops into your mind is Jesus must be talking about the end of the world. It sounds like that, doesn't it? That's what it sounds like. But what Jesus is using in verse 29 is some symbolic language that is well established in the Old Testament. As Brother Steve admonished us a few weeks ago, we've got to pull out our Old Testament decoder ring and figure out what Jesus exactly means by this. And to understand what this type of language means, I'm going to direct your attention to the 13th chapter of the book of Isaiah. We're going to consider several verses there. Isaiah chapter 13, we'll begin in verse 1, but we'll look at several verses within this. Isaiah 13 and 1. As I said, when Jesus talks of the sun being darkened, the moon being darkened, the stars falling from the sky, he's using symbolic or figurative language that is well established within the Old Testament. In fact, we have three or four different examples of this that we can look at this evening, although we'll only look at one. I can give you the other two if you're interested. In Isaiah chapter 13, notice in verse 1 who this prophecy is addressed to. Who is it addressed to? Babylon. It's addressed to Babylon, and this seems to be consistent throughout the entire chapter. God is pronouncing judgment upon the nation of Babylon, and this happens throughout, as I said, this chapter. Notice in verse 17, it begins with Babylon, and notice how it ends. Verse 17, "Behold, I will stir up the Medes against them, who will not regard silver, and as for gold, they will not delight in it." What nation conquered Babylon? Medo-Persian Empire, right? And he talks about the Medes here. "Behold, I will stir up the Medes against them." Okay? Verse 18, "Also their bows will dash the young men to pieces, and they will have no pity on the fruit of the womb. Their eye will not spare children. And Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, the beauty of the Chaldeans' pride, will be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. It will never be inhabited, nor will it be settled from generation to generation, nor will the Arabian pitch tents there, nor will the shepherds make their sheepfolds there. But wild beasts of the desert will lie there, and their houses will be full of owls. Ostriches will dwell there, and wild goats will caper there. The hyenas will howl in their citadels, and jackals in their pleasant palaces. Her time is near to come, and her days will not be prolonged." Very clearly, this is talking about Babylon, and Babylon is not inhabited today. This prophecy has come true. We can see its fulfillment in our day today. So the chapter begins with Babylon, it ends with Babylon, and the interior part of this prophecy also concerns Babylon as well. What's important about this, and why I'm bringing this up in connection with Matthew chapter 24, is what we find in verses 9 and 10. Notice what God says in verses 9 and 10. "Behold, the day of the Lord comes." And this is important. The day of the Lord does not mean the end of time. The day of the Lord is simply a day of judgment. Whether it be on a nation or whether it be on the entire world. The day of the Lord simply means a day of judgment. "Behold, the day of the Lord comes, cruel with both
with both wrath and fierce anger, to lay the land desolate, and he will destroy its sinners from it. For the stars of heaven and their constellations will not give their light, the sun will be darkened in its going forth, and the moon will not cause its light to shine. The beginning of this chapter talks about Babylon, the end of this chapter talks about Babylon, and sandwiched right in between this, notice in verse 10, the very same language that Jesus uses in Matthew chapter 24, verse 29. For the stars of heaven and their constellations will not give their light, the sun will be darkened in its going forth, and the moon will not cause its light to shine. When God created the world, he created the sun to what the day? Rule the day. The sun was to rule the day and the moon was to rule the night. Also in Psalm 136, verses 7 through 9. To him who made great lights, the sun to rule by day, the moon and stars to rule by night. God establishes the sun, moon, and stars as rulers within his symbolic or figurative language, if you will. That's how he set them up at the very beginning. And that's how they continue on through prophetic and figurative language. They symbolize rulers, kingdoms, nations, if you will. So if we're talking about the sun being darkened, the moon being darkened, the stars falling from heaven, or the stars being darkened, what are we talking about? We're talking about the end of a rulership, the end of a nation, the end of a kingdom. That's what we're referring to. And brothers and sisters, in Isaiah chapter 13, what nation's end are we talking about? Babylon. Babylon. When God uses this language, what he's saying is that the day of judgment upon the nation of Babylon has come, and it will come to an end. That its rule, its government, its kingdom, its nation, it will end. It will be dissolved. It will no longer be a nation as it was before. We can look at some other examples of this language in prophecy. Let me just give you a couple passages if you want to look this up on your own. Ezekiel chapter 32, verse 7. This same language is used concerning the judgment of Egypt. And also in Joel chapter 3, verse 15, it's used of the judgment of the Philistine and Phoenician nations as well. The day of the Lord simply means a day of judgment. The sun being darkened, the moon being darkened, the stars being darkened or falling from the sky simply means that the kingdom, the nation, the rulership is going to end. That's what it means. So, if we fast forward to Matthew chapter 24, verse 29, based upon this, based upon how God uses this in Old Testament prophetic language, what can we deduce concerning Christ's meaning? What do we have in Matthew chapter 24, verse 29? We know that this event's going to take place right after the tribulation of those days. And this is what's going to take place. What we have, as I understand it, is the end of the Jewish nation, the Jewish state, the Jewish rulership, such as it was in that day. And I will remind you of a quote I read from Will Durant this morning. And this is essential, I believe. And I'll use the word essential one more time, this quote. Essentially, the destruction of the temple marked the end of the rebellion and of the Jewish state. The destruction of the temple marked the end of the Jewish state. I believe what Jesus is telling us in Matthew 24, verse 29, is that the Jewish nation is going to end at this point. There will no longer be a Jewish nation, a Jewish state. What we have today is not the same as what we had 2,000 years ago. I want to remind you of one thing that occurred around Christ's crucifixion. When Pilate came to the Jews and asked them, "What shall I do with this man, Jesus, who claims to be your king?" Remember what one of their reactions was. "We have no king but Caesar." We have no king but Caesar. Two times in their history, the Jews rejected God as their king. The first time happened with Samuel. In Samuel's days, when Saul was anointed to be king, remember what God said to Samuel. "Don't worry, they haven't rejected you. They've rejected me as their king." And once again, what we have is the Jews rejecting God as their king. "We have no king but Caesar." And as a result of that, their nation is destroyed. Just a thought concerning these things.
Let's take a look at verses 30 and 31. As I stated earlier, I believe 4 through 29 answers this first question. And then I believe in verses 30 and 31, Jesus answers the second question. And back to verse 3, what is that second question? And what will be the sign of your coming? In other words, what signs should we look for to know that you will be returning? And this is based upon his statement, I believe, in Matthew 23:39. Notice the difference in the language between verse 29 and verse 30. In the New King James, in verse 29, it says, immediately. And in verse 30, it says, then. There's a difference between those two words, and I think the difference is worth pointing out. Verse 29, there is an immediacy as that word communicates. But verse 30 tells us a sequence, if you will. In other words, the coming of the Son of Man is going to be after all these things take place. As I understand verses 29 and 30, Jesus is essentially saying this. The Jewish nation will end, then I will return. If my understanding is correct, you and I are somewhere between verses 29 and 30. The Jewish nation has ended at 70 A.D. What we have now is nothing like what that was. We're still waiting for Jesus to return. Verse 30, then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. I will admit that in the evangelist community, verses 29 through 31 is heavily debated. Some believe that 30 and 31 are still connected back with this initial destruction of Jerusalem. I do not. I believe 30 and 31 has to do with the end of time, and here's why. I think verse 31 makes it very plain that this is the final day of the Lord when Jesus returns. There are four specific elements that Jesus lists in verse 31 that are connected with his return. The first one, he will send his angels. The angels are always present with the gathering together, both of the righteous and the wicked. I would point your attention back to Matthew chapter 13, the parable of the tares. In Matthew 13, let me see what verse is that. Verse 41, Jesus is explaining the parable of the tares. And he says this, Matthew 13:41. The Son of Man will send out his angels, and they will gather out of his kingdom all things that offend, and those who practice lawlessness, and will cast them into the furnace of fire. There will be wailing and gnashing of teeth. Here we have the angelic host being used by Christ in order to gather up the wicked and to cast them into everlasting punishment. So the angels are involved with the return of Christ. Also in Matthew chapter 25, verse 31, when the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the holy angels with him, then he will sit on the throne of his glory. The angels always return with Jesus at his final appearance. That's the first element. The second element, notice they will be sent with what? With a great sound of a trumpet. Corbin read for us 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. Now remember that Jesus will descend with a shout, with the voice of an archangel, with the trumpet of God. That's how he's going to return. That's how he's going to appear on that final day. There's the second element, the involvement of a trumpet. The third element, he will gather together his elect. There we have, if you will, the resurrection and the ascension of all the faithful in Christ. His elect will be gathered together. And then finally, the fourth element, notice where they're gathered from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. In prophetic language, using our Dakota ring one more time, recall that four winds means the entire earth. Four corners, four directions, four winds. Jesus is talking about the entire earth, from one end of heaven to the other. He has to be talking about the entire earth, not just one specific place. So to me, Jesus' message in 29, 30, and 31 is this. Jerusalem will be destroyed, then I will return. When? We'll talk about that in just a moment.
I believe 30 and 31 has to be his final appearance based on the four elements found in verse 31. If you have a contrary opinion, I'd be more than happy to hear it. I'm not overly dogmatic on this. I'm still pretty young. I'm not very set in my ways on this yet. So I'd be happy to hear what you had to say about verses 30 and 31. We've looked at 32 through 34. Let's proceed on to verse 35 because we're very short on time. As I mentioned earlier, 4 through 29 and 32 through 34 deal with question 1. Question 2 is answered, in my estimation, in verses 30 and 31. And then finally, question 3, I believe, is answered in verses 35 and following. And if you will, I believe that answer continues on to the 25th chapter as well. We have the parable of the wise and foolish virgins, and then Jesus gives us a picture of the day of judgment in chapter 25. Beginning in verse 35. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will by no means pass away. But of that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only. Recall that the third question is, what will be the sign of the end of the age? And Jesus begins his statement in verse 35 with this: heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will by no means pass away. And then he says in verse 36, but of that day and hour. What day and hour? Let's keep it in context. What day and hour is he talking about? When the heavens and earth pass away. And what does he say concerning that event? No one knows. No one knows when that will be. In fact, I believe, based on Jesus' statement here in verse 36, that even he, as he was uttering this prophecy, had no idea. Why? Because that knowledge has been kept to the Father himself, at least at this point. I don't know if he's revealed that to the Son now. We have no way of knowing that for sure. But I think at least at this point, when Jesus utters this prophecy, it is clear no one knows when the end will come. So, in other words, to answer his question, what will be the sign of the end of the age? Jesus says, there will be no sign of the end of the age. No one knows when it's going to be. Continuing on with his message, beginning in verse 37. But as the days of Noah were, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. Now, to illustrate this, let me use the board just a little bit. Notice in verse 37, he equates the days of Noah with the days of the Son of Man. And in the days of Noah, there were two groups of people, weren't there? Very general groups. What kind of people were alive when Noah was around? We have the wicked, right? And the righteous, correct? Okay? Two groups of people. As the days of Noah were, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. And he explains what he means by that, beginning in verse 38. For as in the days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day that Noah entered the ark, and did not know until the flood came and took them all away. So also will the coming of the Son of Man be. Who was eating and drinking? Who was marrying and giving in marriage? Who was taken away by the flood? The wicked, right? The righteous knew what was coming. God told them some 100 or more years. It was 100 or 120. He gave them a lot of time, though, to build that ark. I remember that. So the wicked were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage. And then the flood came and it took them all away. And by that, I think we would all agree that when Jesus said it took them all away, it means that they were destroyed, right? They were punished. Would we all agree with that? Taking them away means that they were destroyed. They were punished for their iniquity. That's what the flood did. Now notice what happens in verses 40 and 41. Then two men will be in the field, one will be taken, and the other left. Two women will be grinding at the mill, one will be taken, and the other left. Remember in verses 37 through 39, Jesus has established this equality between the days of Noah and the days of the Son of Man. And he says the wicked were eating and drinking, marrying and giving marriage, and they were taken away by the flood. Now keep it in context. Keep your answer in context when I pose this question. Verse 40, who was taken away? Very good. Verse 41, who was taken away? the wicked. And isn't that consistent with the picture that we just read of in the parable of the tares? When the angels came down, they took away the wicked, and where did they throw them? To be punished, right? They were taken away to be punished. That is consistent with the picture that Jesus offers here. As I understand it, verses 40 and 41, those who were taken away are the wicked. And oftentimes people in the religious community in particular will say that it's the righteous who are taken away. That's not how I read this. Not if we keep this in context. Now Jesus says this also in Luke chapter 17. And it seems there that perhaps when he says the person who's taken away, he means the righteous. And I think Jesus' message is consistent. Is anybody going to be here when the world ends? No! The wicked are going to be taken away, according to Matthew 24. And we know, based on what Corbin read in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, at least, we know the righteous are going to be taken away as well. So to say that this has to do with the righteous, I think is a misapplication and takes this passage totally out of context based on what Jesus establishes in verses 37, 38, and 39. Very clearly, he says, he's talking about the wicked there, and I do not think he deviates from that in verses 40 and 41. Jesus, in my estimation, answers, well, I don't have them up there anymore, all three of those questions. He tells us about the destruction of the temple. He tells us about his return. And he tells us about the signs that will come at the end of the age. And what are those signs? There won't be any. Life is going to continue as it always has been. People are going to be eating and drinking and giving, marrying and giving in marriage. That's just the way it's going to be. There will be no imminent sign. There will be no imminent event. People are going to be surprised. As Corbin read today, it's going to come as a thief in the night, or as birth pains upon a woman. And those of you that have been pregnant and have had that come upon you, you know that's pretty sudden at times, isn't it? The thief in the night, birth pains upon a pregnant woman. This is how Jesus is going to return. This is how the world's going to end. So keep this in mind, brothers and sisters, as you read Matthew 24. Jesus is simply answering the questions posed to him, and I do not believe that he deviates from those questions. And I think the text, contextually and historically, supports that understanding. As I see the remainder of Jesus' message concerning the end of time, it's very simple. Wait, watch, and work. That's Jesus' message. Wait, watch, and work. That's all he expects us to do. We don't know when he will return, and all he asks of us is to wait his return, to watch for it, and to work until the end. Don't give up. If you're here this evening and you're not prepared for that end that Jesus has spoken of, then as we well say, in many other instances, we don't know when Jesus will return, and tonight may in fact be your last night. There are things that you need to do in order to prepare your soul. God has offered salvation to you graciously. He has extended this freely to you. He has done more than half of the work. He'll do almost all the work. But he needs a response from you. He needs you to comply with what he has demanded from those who will receive salvation. And those demands are very simple. Believe in the name of his Son. Confess his name before men. Repent of your old ways. Walk in faith the remainder of your days. And be united with Jesus in the waters of baptism. If that's what your desire this evening, then we encourage you to have your sins washed away as we rise and sing the number that Sam has selected.